Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Here I am again, Jared not here. So Jared sends his apologies. He had a function he had to go to in Melbourne, and we only had one day that we could have Karen speak for us because she's doing a moving tour of Australia. So
you've got me tonight.
We haven't got a camera either, so... But we have Radio National here taping this. Where's it going to be recorded?
Big ideas.
So if you want to catch it again, Big Ideas, and we'll podcast it tomorrow. So it's great to welcome Karen Strawn all the way from Canada. She thinks this weather's okay.
I was lying. I was just trying to be nice.
She's heading to the Gold Coast. Things will get better. But Karen's a remarkable person who has sort of created a whole world around her blogging with over 14 million respondents and over 165 subscribers. She's a men's rights advocate, as most of you know. Having seen her on television on Sunday on the Outsiders program, she's totally rational and worth hearing, as we all know. Some people don't agree. And I welcome her to Australia, and let's hear Karen Strawn. Okay, let's...
Directional mic, and you have to kind of speak into it.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Like that.
You're taller than me.
A little bit, yeah. Ah! See, and now I'm making all kinds of noises. Okay, so I don't know how many of you know me. Okay. But just to fill you in, tell you a little bit about myself, get some inevitable questions out of the way, and streamline the Q&A afterwards. No, I don't have mommy issues. No, I don't have daddy issues. I am not a lonely woman who's been unable to form a long-term relationship with a man. I do not only want male attention, and I don't hate women. In fact, I actually think marriage is good for society, and more specifically, I think it is the optimal environment in which we raise our children, and it's necessary for their healthy development. So all of that said, I'm going to talk about a subject. I'm going to make the case that marriage as it exists today, it's just a raw deal for men. It just sucks for men. It's a bargain that involves massive risks and very little benefit. Now, these are issues you probably are all aware of. You might not be aware of them as issues. I would suspect that whether you're a man or a woman, you will have witnessed, whether you want to admit it or not, first or secondhand, some of the things I'm going to talk about tonight. First thing I'm going to ask is this. I'm going to ask you all to think about something. What are the scariest three words you could imagine hearing? I want you to think about that, and I'm going to come back to it in a few minutes. And the next question, which sex, men or women, which sex desires marriage? And no, that doesn't automatically translate into which is the one that pops the question. Which sex desires marriage? And it might surprise you that the answer to that question is the same as the answer to the question, which sex desires divorce. The answer to both is mostly women. In Western cultures, we have a unique perspective on this and a unique ability to understand this because, unlike in more patriarchal cultures, women in the West are capable of financial independence. Both men and women have sexual freedom, and divorce is really easy to come by. It's really easy to acquire one. And you don't you don't even need grounds anymore, let alone an act of parliament the way you did back in Britain a couple hundred years ago. Now, this means that two of the primary drivers of marriage that existed traditionally, women's need for access to men's resources and people's desire for access to sex, they're just gone. You no longer have to pair up for life to get those. Women need the redistribution of resources implicit in marriage less now than they ever have in history. And men don't need to make a lifelong commitment to a woman in order to have a sex life. Neither men nor women need marriage, yet even now women overwhelmingly want it. And it's also, counterintuitively, overwhelmingly women who initiate divorce. But when you actually think about it, it makes a certain sense. If marriage has become not a staple, but a luxury item, well, when it comes to a luxury item, the people who are most able to afford it are the people who are also the most able to throw it away, or the most willing to throw it away or trade it in for something new. Poor people treasure their luxuries. It's rich people that take them for granted. Because we've been doing things this way, no-fault unilateral divorce, for quite a while, women now intuitively understand that they have more to gain from marriage than to lose, and for men, the formulation is the opposite, more to lose than to gain. Women know they will almost always, in cases of divorce, be granted possession of the marriage's most valuable asset. Not the house, not the income, the children. And they also know that whichever party retains possession of the children typically receives the marital home and regular income supplements from the other party. It is a winner-takes-all system. So this is not only about the immediate benefits to men and women within the marital contract, the pooling of resources, an extra set of hands and eyes when it comes to caring for and supervising children, the savings involved in single residence dwelling, and that's savings to the environment as well. Billions of gallons of water would be saved if people were married at the same rate that they were in the 1950s. It's also about projected income outcomes should one party or the other decide to terminate the contract, something that unilateral no-fault divorce allows either party to do, whether the other one wants to go along with it or not. So it's not just about what you gain when you get married. It's also about what you can expect to get or to lose when you divorce. And when one party understands that they are in a position to gain relative to the other by terminating the contract, this provides them with all kinds of leverage in order to, in terms of continually and often unilaterally renegotiating the contract throughout the marriage. And women, consciously or subconsciously, they do bring that leverage to bear. And they do it in order to engage in renegotiation within their marriage. So I'm going to provide an example of this. It's an anecdotal example, but I think you might it might resonate with some people here. I have an acquaintance. We're going to call him Bill. And he's in a very difficult marriage. When he and his wife, we're going to call her Janet, when they married about 5 years ago, they were both extremely high earners. They were high-achieving people. They purchased a home, and they were living a lifestyle based on their combined income, which was, it put them in the top 5% of Canadian households. And when they had a child, Jane unilaterally renegotiated the contract, a contract that they had both agreed to before they got married, a life plan, a way that they had decided before they got married that they were going to do things. She was suddenly completely uninterested in returning to work in her old position as a full-time senior administrator. And soon after having the baby, no way. I don't really blame her for that. I really don't. As a mother, I'm well aware that there is a huge biological imperative that essentially commands you to stay close to your young babies as a mother. Every fiber of your being is screaming at you to not leave them alone for more than 15 minutes at a time. So I can't really fault her for that. But after 6 months, she insisted she wasn't ready to return to work in any capacity at all. After 18 months, she finally decided she would return to work part-time, earning about a quarter of what she had previously because, you know, you can't exactly be a part-time senior administrator. And this is where I do find fault with Janet, because it's here where she becomes a hostile negotiator within her marriage and exploits her leverage in order to call all of the shots. When Janet returned to work part-time, Bill suggested they sell the fancy house that they had purchased, downsize to a more affordable home in a less ritzy neighborhood, and trade in the BMW for something cheaper, to essentially live within their new means. Janet would not hear of it. What would her friends think? After all, nearly everyone in her social circle lived in a gated community full of palatial homes, and here was her husband trying to convince her to downgrade to a four-bedroom, two-bath rancher surrounded by plebs. The more he suggested it, the more she suggested to him that she hadn't married him so she could live in the burbs or drive a used Honda Civic. So for the last 3 years, Bill has been working 60 to 70 hours a week, often hundreds or even thousands of miles away from home for weeks at a time to maintain the lifestyle that Janet is demanding of him. And the horrible thing is, it's not like it makes her happy either. Only a few months ago, he told me, "I haven't seen my kid in a month or my wife naked in 6. If this keeps up, I'm going to cheat. Something's got to give." Now, she complains to him constantly that he's never around, and that when he is around, he's not emotionally available to her. Now, why isn't he around? Well, because he's doing what she's demanding of him. He's earning enough to give her what she insists on having, and that means being away. And why is he emotionally unavailable when he's home? Because if he actually told her how he really feels about the situation, if he actually opened up and put it all out there, where you can't take it back, I can pretty much guarantee you she'd pack up that kid and leave. And he knows that. And he knows what it means, too. It means alimony. It means child support. It means him paying for that same house, but not being able to live in it. And it means seeing his kid even less than he does now. Under the law as it stands now, if she chooses to leave him, he cannot do anything about it. Divorce can be unilateral and for any reason or no reason at all. And who was at fault for the breakdown of the marriage? Who is the one with the problem, with the attitude, with the issues, right? That has zero impact on who is entitled to what, the responsibilities and the entitlements of the spouses. Even if she was found to be 100% recalcitrant and unreasonable, if she's fit to parent, she will still get primary custody. And he'll still have to pay generous maintenance because she's the primary carer and he's the primary earner. In fact, on the surface of things, if I were a feminist, I would look at them and I would say, they're the typical couple we all talk about, where the wife has tragically sacrificed her career to raise this man's children. You heard me. According to feminists, she's the victim. Look at what she gave up. This beautiful, glamorous career, high-powered and high-achieving and high-earning. Also, he could pursue the higher pay, the status, and career advancement at the expense of hers. So, is Bill supposed to drop this feelings bomb on her? Is he supposed to do it now? Or is, you know, should he continue to tie himself in knots trying to keep her from leaving for one more day, then one more week, then one more month? What's he supposed to do when she has this sword against his neck and they both know it? So I'm going to come back around to that first question I asked you. What do you all think are the most three most terrifying words a man could imagine hearing? And I can tell you what they are. I'm not happy. I'm not happy. For many men, those three words are the harbinger of a life-changing, sometimes life-destroying sequence of events over which they will have virtually no control. Their estranged wives will lead the entire dance in family court, often armed with free legal counsel, the assistance of social workers and government agencies, all helping her navigate a system that already grants mothers full custody and fathers ongoing responsibility, financial responsibility, by default. Approximately 70% of divorces are initiated by women, and in the majority of cases, the reason given is not abuse, it is not abandonment, it's not even irreconcilable differences. It's dissatisfaction. It's, I'm not happy. I'm not happy, so I'm going to break up my family. I'm not happy, so I'm going to turn my children's lives upside down. I'm not happy, so I'm going to force my husband into a position where if he doesn't keep earning the way he is right now, he can be put in prison. I'm not happy, so I'm going to turn my kid's father into an every other weekend dad. When I've talked about people like Bill and Janet in the past, I usually get bombarded with comments. He just needs to be honest with her. He just needs to put his foot down. He just needs to assert himself. And this ignores the reality of the situation. Both Bill and Janet are well aware of the power Janet has if she chooses to be annoyed by any such audacity on his part, and of the leverage it bestows on her in the constant renegotiation of their marriage. Is Bill really in a position to put his foot down and insist that they downsize their home and begin living within their new means? Is he really in a position to tell her he's quitting the job that pays for all of this, but keeps him away for weeks at a time in favor of one that pays less and allows him to be home every night? Is he really in a position, heaven forfend, to insist that she go back to work? No. Can he do those things when they both know that the moment he annoys her, she can harness the system to keep him exactly where he is now in terms of his job and his financial responsibilities to her and the child, all while maintaining her own lifestyle and downgrading him to a studio apartment and every other weekend status? This, ladies and gentlemen, is where men are right now, and it permeates every aspect of the relationship between men and women within marriage. And I'm going to give you an example of that. Have any of you ever heard, I don't know, this is Canadian and American parlance, but a honey-do list. Do you guys know what that is? Oh, excellent. In North America, this is a list of tasks a woman gives her husband on the weekend, on his days off. Honey, do this. Honey, do that. Honey, stain the deck. Honey, fix the bathroom faucet. Honey, rake the leaves. Honey, change the oil in the car and get it washed. Honey, trim the hedge and fertilize the lawn. Honey, fix the squeak in the floor. The honey-do list is completely uncontroversial where I come from, at least in this form. No one thinks twice about it. No one would ever bat an eye over a woman, say, ripping a page out of a Home and Garden magazine, handing it to her husband and saying, make the yard look like this. Now imagine what would happen if men had a honey-do list. Filled with traditionally feminine things they'd hand to their wives on the weekend. Honey, cook prime rib tonight, and don't forget the Yorkshires. Honey, bacon and eggs Saturday morning. In bed, please. Honey, the kitchen baseboards are looking a little dingy. They could use a scrub. Right? Honey, take my suit to the cleaners. Honey, I want cupcakes. Honey, bring me a beer. Honey, I could sure use a steak and a blowjob. Even in marriages where both parties arrange things along traditional lines, this would be unheard of. It would be considered gauche at best, boorish and misogynistic at worst. How dare a man have these sexist expectations of his wife? How dare he obligate her to serve him in these demeaning and sexist ways? Does he think he's living in the 1950s? But that's not what it's about. It's not about gender roles, because this, at the same time, what would be the reaction if a man handed his wife a honey-do list with items like, honey, change your own damn tire. Uh-huh. Honey, fill the cars up with gas, would you? Honey, install that new light fixture in the kitchen this weekend. Honey, don't you think the leaves could use raking? Honey, the fence needs repair. I don't think that would go over well either. And at the same time, what if a woman gave her husband a list with items like, honey, empty the diaper pail. Honey, do the dishes. Honey, throw in a load of laundry. Honey, take Becky to ballet. That wouldn't be a big deal. We just expect that. The sexism at play here is not about sexist expectations, traditional expectations of women or men. It's about which sex is even allowed to have expectations of their partner. And when one partner is allowed to have them and the other is not, I would hope that we would be able to see that that tells us something about the power distribution in the relationship. Men are not in a position to have expectations of their wives and make demands. Women are in that position when it comes to their husbands. And I'm sorry, but that's not a partnership. That's an inherently exploitative relationship, one where a man can be dismissed at any time for any or no reason and yet still be held to his side of the bargain. You still have to put in the same work, you just don't get any reward at all. Is it any wonder that men are becoming disillusioned with the idea of marriage? That a growing number of men are not only saying they won't ever get married, but they'll never live with a woman, never share space with a woman, never trust a woman further than they can throw her in terms of the decision to use a condom or not, to trust her about birth control. Because doing any of these things can legally obligate a man to a woman and or a child without providing him with any benefits, privileges, or rights. He's like that divorced guy, but he wasn't even married in the first place. Live with a woman long enough, the law considers you common law married, with all the attendant legally enforceable responsibilities to a woman who bears no such responsibilities toward you. You owe her and that child money. She does not owe you anything more than Tuesday evenings and every other weekend with your son or daughter. Trust the wrong woman when she says she's got birth control covered. Say hello to a $200,000 baby mortgage amortized over the next 18 to 26 years. And as an added bonus, you'll have to apply in court at your own expense for any parental rights, and they may or may not be granted to you. And here is where we see the true nature of the issue. What is and what was marriage? What is it for? Ask a feminist, particularly one who is of the second wave. They'd tell you that marriage as an institution was created by men to subordinate women and to exploit them for sex, for their reproductive ability, and for their free domestic services. A wife, to many such feminists, is sexual chattel, a brood mare and a domestic slave. The enterprise of marriage was a one-way contract with the husband reaping all the benefits and the wife relegated to sexual, reproductive, and domestic serfdom. But as marriage has become less necessary to both men and women, what aspects of marriage remain? Certainly not the traditional roles of wife and mother, We have done our level best as a society to mitigate the situation for a woman who might find herself accidentally pregnant and unwilling to become mother. Abortion and emergency contraception are legal and accessible, and in most Western countries, new mothers are able to legally abandon their children via safe haven or baby Moses laws and, you know, just hand them over to the state and walk away from any responsibility toward them. Women have more than a dozen highly effective forms of birth control at their disposal so that they can decouple the act of sex from the condition of motherhood. No husband can legally force his wife into sex. That's rape. No husband can legally coerce his wife into having his child. That's a form of domestic violence called reproductive coercion. No husband can legally require his wife to contribute to the household in any particular way, like staying home to take care of the kids, or even going out and getting a job. That's not allowed. So what remains of marriage? The man's moral and financial responsibility toward wife and child. Not only during the marriage, but after divorce, no matter who broke up the family or for what reason. And not only does this responsibility remain regarding marriage, we have increasingly imposed these responsibilities, these traditionally male contributions to marriage, on men who never chose to be married, who didn't get married, on men who have foolishly lived with a woman for more than 6 months, or who've contributed intentionally or otherwise, willingly or against their consent, to a pregnancy. As fewer people than ever choose to get married, we have responded by forcing the traditional obligations of marriage on unmarried men. We routinely tell men who are tricked into fatherhood, if you didn't want to be a father, you should have kept it in your pants. How reminiscent is that of arguments of pro-life advocates when opposing abortion and even birth control? And it constantly amazes me how the very same people who would never accept that argument regarding a woman's right to choose will trot it out when men complain about a single mistake tethering them to a huge financial obligation that can and frequently does completely disrupt their educational and career aspirations. In the U.S., things are so lopsided that a woman can legally abandon a child without the father's knowledge or consent, absolving herself of any and all obligation to it, a child that only exists because she unilaterally made the decision to bring it into the world. While at the same time, the state will garnish the income from a 15-year-old boy's paper route to pay child support to the adult woman who served prison time for raping him. And the state will then require that boy apply to court at his own expense for visitation rights to the child, while providing the mother with a free lawyer so she can oppose his motions in court. What does all of this tell us about what marriage was actually for? You know, going by the things, the parts of it that we've kept, that we don't want to let go, that we're willing to expand. If marriage 2.0 is the imposition of obligations on men who engage with women sexually, whether or not they ever bothered to pop the question, then what was marriage 1.0 all about? Was it really about the subjugation of women, the way feminists have always suggested? Or was it about identifying the fathers of children and holding those men responsible for those children and their mothers? That is what marriage was. That's its purpose. And where does all of this leave men these days? In Japan, over the last decade, an increasing number of men under 30 are being described by cultural analysts as soshoku danshi, or grass-eating men. They have no interest in marriage, but what's more, they have no interest in dating, no interest in sex, no interest in full-time work. And they spend more money on cosmetics than women do. It's a very, very strange phenomenon. Economists in Japan are losing their collective minds over this because their entire economy has been built on the willingness of men to put in long days getting things done in order to generate a surplus of productivity for the benefit of women and children. What happens when huge numbers of these men just go on strike? When they throw up their hands and say, the juice is just not worth the squeeze? Some interesting numbers came out of New Zealand back in 2015, I believe, crunched by the government and Victoria University. They examined the cumulative contributions to the tax system of men and women over a lifetime. So essentially, you start out with a bank account, the balance is zero, you have an overdraft, and they just keep track all through your life. Now, you start with zero, and then you go into your overdraft because you're being educated, you're using healthcare, and you're a child. Around 20 to 24, when you finish school and start working, you begin putting tax money back into the system. Now, the data reveal some concerning realities. If the average man dies at his retirement party, age 65, he will have put $55,000 more into the system than he took out. That's at his peak. If the average woman dies at age 65 at her retirement party, she will have taken almost $50,000 more out of the system than she has put in. By the time a man's 80, his net cumulative contribution to the tax system is zero. He's broken even. If the average woman lives to 80, she dies $150,000 in the red. And the most terrifying thing about this research is that it found the only group that pays more taxes in than they take out is men aged 40 to 65. The closest women ever come is being almost $50,000 overdrawn. It's men 40 to 65 who are carrying the whole shebang. And what have we been doing as a society? We've turned marriage into a rigged game that any sane man would avoid, like the Black Death. We've tried to compensate for the decline in marriage by coercing marital responsibilities from unwilling men at the point of a gun, on threat of prison. Countries like Sweden have proposed a man tax for men to subsidize women. They get to pay an extra 10% to pay for women's shit. Pardon my language. And struggling cultures in decline since the Roman Empire have proposed bachelor taxes and have even pressed men into marriage by denying them citizenship rights should they decline the invitation. This is what happens at the end of civilizations. Men start saying, it's not worth it. And what do societies do? They try to force them back in there with a stick instead of using a carrot. And the really sad thing is, coercive and punitive measures do seem to work in the short term, but they aren't enough to keep a civilization going or to keep its men invested in it. And we do need men. Men are overwhelmingly the people who keep the lights on, the water running, and the planes from falling out of the sky. They are overwhelmingly the people who produce our food and move it from farm to market. They are overwhelmingly the people who guard our borders, who police our streets, who carry injured and sick people to the hospital. They are the producers and suppliers of the raw materials we consume in refined form every day of our lives, from wood to oil to natural gas to potash to the magnesium in your cell phone battery. We need men, every single one of us, and they are bugging out. They've had enough. They are failing out of school. They are increasingly not in employment, education, or training. They are failing to launch, and when they do launch, they're not as interested as they used to be in landing in a nest of their own with a woman and producing children with her. And to be frank, I really can't blame them. We built an entire culture around disrespecting them, treating them like monsters or idiots. And even when they step up and do what they are supposed to do, when they put in the hours and the effort to give us what we have demanded of them, we'll still happily take away their kids and then, as Robin Williams once beautifully put it, rip their genitals out through their wallets. Divorce. That's the Latin definition, apparently. We can force them all we like. We can shame them all we like. We can call them Peter Pans, men, children, man, babies, stunted adolescents, fragile males, whiners, losers, whatever you want. We can talk until we're hoarse about what real men are supposed to do. It doesn't matter, because for a growing number of men, it's starting to be the case that the juice is just not worth the squeeze, and no matter how much shame, blame, or even coercion you pile on them, they are not going to come back in line. They are not going to continue giving us what we need. So what do we do? Do we keep up what we're doing right now? Or do we maybe start thinking of a different way to think about men and a different way to treat them? Maybe what we need to do is to begin to see what men actually do for us. We need to appreciate it. We need to reward it. We need to equalize the gendered imbalance of power within the institution of marriage. We need to make it a good deal for men again. And we need to make it a safe deal. And we need to change the cultural discourse as a whole. We need to get away from monsters and idiots, right? And get to looking at what men really are. We need to consider men a vital and necessary part of the families they help form and provide them with equitable rights and respect that they're due when they take on that burden, because it is a burden. But more importantly, to my mind, we need to start realizing, and this may not seem that radical, but it really is, that men are people too. They hurt and they suffer, and when they do, and they tell us about it, and the first thing we do is twist the knife in deeper, we need to ask ourselves what that says about us. Unless and until society is prepared to do that, I'm going to continue to recommend that men stay as far away from marriage and even women as they possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. I'm feeling increasingly threatened here. And the problem is that if I had a honey do it list, Jared wouldn't be able to do most of the things you just suggested. Because I do all that sort of practical
stuff. I do it too.
Yeah, I know. That's why we're still married. That was great, although I don't agree with everything. But what I'm interested in is someone said to me last night, a man I know from way back, and he looked at me and said, "Oh, you're a feminist." He said, "How can you possibly be having someone like that talk for you?" And blah, blah, blah. And I said, "You've got to listen. There are things that have to be said." And what I'd like to know is what brought you, a female, to this position? Because there's a lot of poking fun at honey badgers. And I'd like you to just describe for us your experience of how you got to this position.
Okay, how did I get here? Well, Bettina has, in all of the press materials, she's described my experience in negotiating my divorce and the fact that I really wasn't allowed to be as fair as I would have liked to be with my ex. Judges and attorneys and the system would not allow me to negotiate the agreement that I wanted to with him. I felt like I'm taking sole custody of the kids, so I should take sole responsibility for them. That seems only fair, especially given his situation at the time. And my lawyer told me straight up, no judge is ever going to sign a divorce decree without a child support order attached to it. So we have two choices. We let the judge impute an income on him, or we do it ourselves. And if we do it ourselves, we can pick a number that is not going to completely destroy him. And I will let you know that I haven't actually enrolled in any enforcement agencies or taken any measures to collect that money. But it was kind of eye-opening for me in terms of the lawyers, even my lawyer, who his main practice was in mediation. So it wasn't like he was one of these cutthroat family law attorneys that really wants a big custody battle that's going to rake him in lots of dough. He was constantly recommending that, you know, you only have this tiny little bit of money. You shouldn't blow it on fighting this out, right? But how difficult it was to be fair through that process. And So that got me thinking, and it actually got me reading about men's issues. And then when my partner over there, when I started dating him, he had a very, very difficult breakup that involved a child and him losing access to her and having no legal recourse because she, you know, he'd raised her since she was 5-6 months old for, you know, 6.5 years, but she wasn't biologically his. And so it doesn't matter that what always struck me about that was that the only two people who even gave a, pardon my language, gave a crap about, well, pardon my language again, about
this
them.
Is Australia.
All right, gave a shit about them, about their relationship. The only two people who cared were this little girl and her daddy, and they were the only two people who didn't get a say at all. They had no say whatsoever in how anything worked out. And so when he kind of nudged me in the direction of talking about stuff like this, I, you know, I was very passionate about just getting out there and talking online. I didn't think I would ever make a career out of it. It was sort of one of those, someone is wrong on the internet, I'm going to spend 2 hours, you know, tonight surfing around and informing people of how they're wrong. And, oh, it's, you know, and still, I mean, some of that is still my motivation because, you know, that's just who I am. But I, the more feedback I got, and, you know, he, again, he sort of suggested I start a blog, and then, oh, God, one night I came home from work, and he said, you're gonna be really angry at me. I was like, what did you do? He says, I sent a link to your first blog post to Warren Farrell, to Dr. Warren Farrell, the author of The Myth of Male Power, and, women can't hear what men don't say and why men earn more and all of these different books, right? This very, very, very admired icon within the men's movement. And I was just like, I am so going to kill you. I'm just going to go out in the backyard and start digging the hole right now. You just stay here. And then an hour later, Warren Farrell emailed me back and said, that was just absolutely wonderful. You know, you really need to just keep it up and keep going and do what you're doing, right? Just keep it up. And then after I got sick of being accused of being a man, and not just a man, but a fat, ugly, neck-bearded loser who lives in his mother's basement and can't get laid, I decided to start making videos. Because they used to accuse me of, you just snag that picture off of Flickr or something like that, that picture on your blog, that's not really you, you're just a horrible, ugly man. And because no woman would think the way you think, right? And so I started doing videos, and then it just really snowballed. And the more emails poured in, the more positive responses from men, the more men who emailed to say, thank you so much. It's like you put into words all of these things that I've been feeling for so long. The more emails that poured in saying, you changed my mind about suicide. Or saying, you changed my mind about hating women. Which is the one that really surprised me, considering that I'm accused of propagating and promoting hatred of women. I get guys who are like, I was really starting to hate women, but now it's like I don't feel that way anymore. It's like I just kind of understand what's going on now. Thank you. So that's how I got into this, and just, yeah.
Thanks, Karen. Could we just bring the mic around?
Oh, I've got lots of emails. Like, oh, you know, it's a mixed bag from both men and women. I mean, I probably get about 5% negative, 95% positive emails from both men and women. I do get a lot of supportive emails from women. I get emails from women who told me that after watching my videos or reading my blog or whatever, they no longer call themselves feminists. that, you know, like, so it's, you know, and really the level, the negativity, what little there is it's usually off where I don't see it, right? So it's not coming into my inbox, in my email. It's not directed to me directly on Twitter. People go off into their own little echo chambers and they talk smack about me. And usually they've blocked me from being able to comment. But
talking about you, not to you.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's exactly, yeah, like, how dare you? I mean, I remember going on, there was, somebody had to, on Reddit, which is, I don't know if you know what Reddit is. Yeah. It's like this big, huge, it's like a news and link aggregator website. Millions of people use it. And if somebody types out your username, your full username, you get a little alert. You know, somebody's mentioned your username. So I go into that conversation, and it's in this one very feministy sub-forum on this website. And they were talking specifically about me, and there were some things that were being said, and I didn't really even care about the whole, oh, she's such a horrible person, oh, she's a misogynist, right? But they were actually making some errors of fact in terms of, like, how old I was and, you know, how many kids I had and things like that, right? And so I went in and I left comments to correct those, and they got deleted, and I got told that I wasn't allowed to comment there because I was not an approved commenter. And so that's the kind of stuff that's the negativity that I experience. It's not generally doesn't arrive in my inbox. They I think they might worry that I would reply.
And I don't want
Chris?
I agree with what you're saying. But what role, and you talked about the civil aspect of relationships in terms of men and women.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Romans in terms of they brought the concept of marriage in because they had all these kids running around Rome who didn't have fathers looking after them.
Marriage has been around a lot longer than that.
Yeah, but they looked after them. They created the institution in terms of having it as a civil.
Yes, yes.
There's not a... So, that's leading to my question. What role do you think religion has played in either supporting or disagreeing with what you think the role of marriage is in terms of men and women?
Well, I think, you know, whether you come at it from a civil perspective or a religious perspective, I mean, it's sort of all going for the same thing. I mean... You have to realize that the justifications, the sort of religious justifications for certain traditions are not necessarily going to reflect the functions that those traditions, the reason why we have those traditions and why they worked, right? So you can say, oh, well, religions, marriage, you know, was just all about, you know, God will hate you if you have sex without being married, and he'll send you to hell. And, you know, we're a secular society and we don't really believe that anymore, so marriage is obsolete, right? But that's not the function of marriage. That's just the justification for it. And I think that given the breadth of populace, you know, the sort of span of humanity that religions were dealing with, it was very easy to just say, God wants you to do this, and if you don't do it, you'll go to hell. Right, rather than try and, you know, give some kind of treatise on, you know, the socioeconomic impacts of, you know, two-parent households and lifelong monogamy. So, you know, and I don't even know whether we really understood those ourselves. Things like this, society is an organism too, right? And it evolves, and so adaptations that work take root, and you know, things that don't, they go away. And sometimes in a situation like now, I think that we have such an overabundance of everything, or an illusory overabundance of everything, because really we're selling, we're purchasing the largesse of today on our grandkids' backs is what we're doing. But then we're not actually having grandkids because, you know, of the way we're doing things. So we think we can afford to throw all of this stuff away. I don't think that we can. And really, when you look at the cyclical nature of the problem, when you have fatherless children who are much more likely to end up in prison, and they're much more likely to end up in, you know, into drugs and in gang culture, and you know, teen parents having children outside of wedlock, dropping out of school, being violent, having behavioral problems, having learning disabilities, all of these things that fatherless children are more prone to, being runaways, being sexually abused, being victimized by violence, and even probably being murdered. When you look at all of those things and you think, well, and so every, then you look at those two little beautiful ones that are so cyclical, is that becoming teen parents and having children outside of relationships. So you're just perpetuating this same sort of deconstruction of the whole thing. And it's not going to be fun for everybody. It's completely unsustainable. I mean, we can keep putting kids in prison or in juvenile detention facilities, right? But that's not productive. It's not boosting our standard of life. So, and it's not paying for any of this either. So, yeah.
Question over here. Put it right close to
that. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
I'm definitely one of the people who you've convinced or rather inspired to be far more anti-feminist than feminist from your blog. So
oh, awesome.
My question is, I would definitely say that you're a very rational woman. Do you find that comes as your first instinct, or do you find, like you were talking about before with your example of a woman who has an innate biological imperative, that there's some kind of first response within you that is a more traditional woman's response that you then have to fight through rational thought, or is your first response fairly rational?
That's actually a good question. That's a good question. My first response is generally to just be lazy. I'm just, because that's what he would say. I'm not really excitable, and I've never been particularly excitable. I did feel that intense pull, but you know, towards being very close to my children for at least the first, you know, 2 to 3 years after I had them. I did a lot of stuff in order to make that possible. I rescued and reupholstered furniture instead of buying new. I, you know, refinished things. I had built furniture from scratch. I built a TV stand while I was 7 months pregnant, using my coffee table in my living room as a workbench. Because that's what you have to do in order to save enough money. I used those cloth diapers, not the ones with the fancy Velcro, but the ones that you have to fold and pin, like from like the 1920s. Yeah. So, because it was cheaper, and that was what would allow me to be able to stay home. And so, essentially, even though it was something that I really, really, really wanted to do, I knew on the, you know, rational side of things that I would have to actually make sacrifices. And I think we used to roll my birthday, my ex's birthday, and Valentine's Day, and our anniversary into one dinner out a year with the kids. So that's how we worked that. And that was a very rational way of trying to deal with something that was highly emotional. But generally, I'm not very emotional. So.
I'm not sure
that's working anyway.
I'd like your opinion on interfaith marriage. Happening a lot in this country and in Canada as well, I'm aware. What's your opinion of interfaith marriage, the difficulties, and of course, when there's divorce?
Well, I mean, if you're getting a divorce in a normal court, like, are you talking difficulties in divorce if you go through an ecclesiastical court or a Sharia court, or...
if you're going through the courts of the law of the land.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you might not get what you want if you're a Muslim, but... or if you're, you know... That's a difficult thing. You know, I don't really have any problem with interfaith marriages. I think they can work. I think that interpolitical marriages can also work to a degree. He used to call himself a feminist up until about 3 years ago when I finally convinced him to give it up. But he was just like, no, I believe in equality. And I was like, stop it. I come from too secular a background to even really understand what the problems would be. I mean, when my dad went to the matron of my mom's family, Mamer, and asked her if, she called him to her. He'd asked my mom to marry him, and Mamer called him to her and gave him the interrogation, the Spanish Inquisition. Very, very Catholic. And she pulled my mom aside afterwards, and she says, he says he won't join the church. Marry him anyway. So that's really been my attitude towards all of that kind of stuff. So
over there, the young lady.
Hi, Karen. You know I'm a big fan, and I'm not doing this to stump you, but I'd just like to see your opinion on the situation, say, a short-term boyfriend and accidentally fall pregnant, contraception fails, legitimately fails. And personally, I wouldn't see abortion as an option because I see it's morally wrong, and the female sees it as morally wrong, and she offers it to him to have equal custody of the child, but he rejects it. Doesn't want to have anything to do with the child. Does she have any right to, or do you see it as morally wrong for her to ask for some contribution for him, from him?
Well, I mean, there are three people here, right? And the one person who is always, three people, all of them who have rights, and the one person who is never considered in this equation in terms of rights and the ability to choose and all of those things is the man. The child has a right to support, whether it's by one or both parents or whether it's by the state. The woman has the right to, you know, keep the child. She also has the right to support, usually from the state. And so, like, given the situation as it is now, where subsidized housing for you if you got pregnant and had a baby would be, you know, a townhouse, you know, sort of very inexpensive, paid for in part by the government and food stamps and all kinds of help, right? And subsidized housing for
Australia isn't that nice.
No.
it's pretty bad.
Whatever, but subsidized housing for him is prison. You know, if you can't afford to support your child, you get help. If he can't afford to support his child, right, even if he didn't choose to have one, he gets prison. And, yeah, so I would say, you know, if I had my druthers, and it sounds really heartless, but I would say that women should have to secure the willing contractual contribution of a man, so he would have to agree to it, and he would have to have rights to go along with that, whether he chooses to exercise them or not. And if he doesn't agree to it, he has no rights, he has no obligations. And I would say, a lot of people say, oh, you know, maybe that would be okay, you know, for the first 3 months until the woman could maybe have an abortion, right? The first 3 months of the pregnancy, so she could make her decision. I would say no. That should be just across the board. His default setting should be no. No to parenthood. And therefore, if you want his contribution, talk nice, convince him, or go it alone. Right? Because that's ultimately your decision to bring that child into the world and to keep it. And
I don't see abortion as an actual option.
Well, you still have those safe haven laws, and you still have all this extra help, right? So asking him for child support is not the same as you deciding to keep the baby, because once you ask him, once you get him in the system for child support, you know, you can keep the baby and go on and live your life, right? If he loses his job and stops paying for, you know, 6 months, he can land himself in prison. So that's just, it's just not, it's not something that, yeah, no, I would say for men who are not married, the answer is no, straight across the board. And if you want it to be something different, you need to convince him.
Okay, well, we always finish at 7. And now there are more questions. I'm sure Karen would be happy to...
I'll go stand out on the street and smoke, chain smoke, and answer all your questions.
It's been a fascinating discussion.
You've opened up all kinds of questions for a lot of us.
All right.
This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia.
Awesome. And thank you very much for
enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.